oh, report. There. 10, 11. Pretty sure we're on.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so we'll start the interview since we have the tape going.
Okay.
So I start by introducing myself. I'm Bea Cherniak, and I am the person who will be speaking to Mr. Ken Eady this morning, and it's November the 22nd, 2011. So we always start the interview by having you give your name and how you came to work in the grain trade.
Well, my name is Kenneth Eady, and we were dairy producers. We gave that up and went strictly into grain production. And I became the vice president of Manitoba Pool Elevators.
Okay, we'll go back to right to the beginning again, dairy producers. Did you grow up on a farm, or?
Very much so, yeah.
Could you tell us a bit about that? Where was the farm, and how long did your parents
farm? It was 2 miles west of here and 1.5 miles north.
Of Dugald?
Of Dugald.
And what kind of farm was that when you were growing up?
Well, when I was growing up, we had dairy, and then we shifted into probably grain production. And as time went on, and the sons were able to run the farm, I didn't literally move into the city, but that's where my focus was, in the grain trade, which is on Lombard Avenue, is where the grain exchange was at that time.
And were there a number of, you said you were one of the sons of this, in this, on this farm?
Yes.
How many of the family continued farming or being in the grain industry?
Oh, now only one nephew, Wayne, is farming on quite a large scale. And you see the elevator out here?
Mm-hmm.
He bought that. And so he can ship producer cars from there. And the neighbors can ship producer cars. And if the Canadian Grains Commission, if you own the company, then you get into a whole bunch of bureaucracy. But by just charging a tariff, then you're okay. And neighbors and friends will line up and haul grain. And because there's so many bins, they can keep it segregated until they get enough to load a rail car.
That's in 2011 that's happening.
Well, yes, it started about 5 years ago.
Okay.
And it's getting more popular all the time. And what Wayne does, he has a couple of semi-trailers on the road, and the grain he produces and purchases without owning it.
Mm-hmm.
And they hauls a lot down into the United States. Wheat, barley, canola, flax.
Okay.
There's not much rye growing around here.
Okay. I'm going to go backwards again, taking you back to, you were on the farm, and you mentioned that your focus became on Lombard after the farm, and you had a brother who then farmed?
Yes.
Okay, so there were two boys that carried on in the grain industry out of your siblings?
Well, there were six in the family, and I was the youngest.
Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, after they made all the mistakes with the other five, I was raised perfectly because I knew what to do.
All right. So out of the six, how many were in the grain industry?
None directly. You know, producing grain, but not being involved in policy.
Okay, but they farmed.
Yes. And
and then you went on to...
once once the family was big enough to manage the farm,
right.
I didn't physically move because we're not that far away, and got involved in all aspects of the grain trade.
So what was your first job?
My first job was the vice president of Mount Overpool Elevators.
Okay. And did
an agricultural diploma from the University of Manitoba,
okay.
which enabled you to, what you learn is not important because you all forget about, but the contacts you make and the professors at the university, they all liked us because we were, in effect, right on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to know what theories they had were right and what was wrong and what was the best way to go into their research programs.
That's great. That's really good. So you graduated with your diploma. You went to work for Manitoba Pool.
Well, not right away, because I spent about 10 years milking cows. We gave up the bad habit of milking cows about 1975.
Okay.
Then we carried on with grain. And
so when you did go to work at Manitoba Pool,
mm-hmm.
can you describe your job, your first job there, your duties?
As I said, I was first vice president. And what we did was, if you want to know something about the workers, go and talk to them. And that was my job, to go and say, this is working and this isn't. What should we do to improve it? And then I'd take that back to head off to a real farmer who was in the industry and could help them sort out their problems. And they really liked to see you come, because they would say, well, you're doing this wrong and that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what should we do? Do it this way? Okay. So then I take that back and say, here is the problem, and here's how we can solve it.
Would you call meetings in certain districts? How would you find the people to talk to?
In the Manitoba Pool system, they had regular monthly meetings of interested people who were interested in Manitoba Pool, and they made up a board, and they had a president, of course, and they always felt that now they had somebody who talked to, who understood farming and what should be done in research and mm-hmm. technology situations.
And you were the vice president of Manitoba Pool for how many years?
I would guess 7.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then went on, we had Alberta Wheat Pool, Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, and Manitoba Wheat Pool. We created something that we could get together and talk about what's going on. Then eventually we started a lobbying process, and I was a lobbyist that was registered in Ottawa, and then I could go down there and point out to our Ottawa friends some things they could do better in the regards to the grains industry.
So were you hired by the group to then become a lobbyist?
Yeah, well, as I said, there was Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and we put what we got called Prairie Pools Incorporated.
Okay.
And I was chairman of that.
What, around what year would that have been?
75, we quit milking cows. I would say about 1980.
And what was changing in the industry at that point that would suggest that you would go in that direction?
Well, the government was changing, and there was something called the method of payment, and there was great controversy amongst farmers as to how that should be organized.
Okay. Can you tell me what method of payment was? Can you talk about that concept and then the farmers' reaction?
because the method of payment. And when the crow rate subsidy stopped, then there was a great controversy, kind of a tribal war, about what should be done to carry on from there.
And what were they suggesting that should happen?
Well, they wanted to be able to make contact directly with Ottawa.
Farmers?
Well, yes. And it fell upon me to be the one that had to go to Ottawa 6 times a year to try and keep the government in line. And one of the things that we found out very quickly was Transport Canada was not interested in the consumers of oil, grain, sulfur, whatever. They were only interested, Transport Canada was interested that the railways made money. And we thought that was kind of a narrow focus.
So you were a lobbyist for how many years?
4 or 5, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, you said you were the chairman of the Prairie Pools
Incorporated.
Was that a full-time job for you?
Yes.
Okay.
Very much so.
And that was for about 7 years?
About that.
And is there a lobbying group to this day? Does this still exist?
Yes, in a number of ways.
It took some different forms afterwards?
Well, I wouldn't say it took different forms, but when I left, I mean, there were various lobbyists that, and I knew them and able to give them bits of advice as how to get your ideas through the bureaucracy in Ottawa.
Who would the other lobbyists be at that point? Where would they represent?
Well, I really don't know how to answer that question. But I just know that there were a great deal. Name names, Barry Simpson, who I knew well from Saskatchewan, and he became the manager of something called CIGI, which is the Canadian Industrial Greens. And the way that worked, and people couldn't understand it, was we would bring at our cost, at Canada's cost, people from foreign countries to come and see how the Canadian greens industry worked. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, you think that's giving away intellectual technology. But what did happen, these people understood the Canadian greens industry, and they went back to their home countries. They knew who to contact to get the grain they wanted, the quality, and because they trusted that the CIGI, which is CIGI, it's an acronym. And we saw time after time where these people would come not knowing anything about Canada or about our grains industry, and because they felt confident that we knew something, and there were huge orders, like there was 50,000 tons of canola oil ordered after they came, and we had nutritionists saying what wonderful stuff canola oil was. And they would buy very confidently.
Well, good. When you left the Prairie Pools Incorporated, where did you next go in your career?
Well, there was something called the Canadian Grains Industry, mm-hmm. and I became a member of the board. And that was all grain from Vancouver to Newfoundland, which is no grain in Newfoundland. It's pretty hard to grow grain on a rock.
Yes.
And it was just very interesting, because then you got all sorts of domestic policies and it just worked.
So it sounds, and you can correct me, but it sounds like you were a person who was very interested in systems and policy and the big picture
Yes.
for the grain industry.
And one of the best things they said was, I listened to everything carefully and then looked at both sides and then made a suggested direction to go.
Well, that's good. I'm going to be moving back and forth in your so after the Canadian Grain Industry Board, where did you go?
Well, one thing which is different was a thing called CARC, Canadian Agricultural Research Committee. And the focus of that group was to look for duplication, where two people were studying the same thing, and they're both going to come to the same conclusion, but it costs twice as much money to have them. And so that was why we had CARC, and I was on the board for a number of years. I had to go to Ottawa again. And that's about it.
And did you do any other positions? I'm trying to go all the way up to your retirement, and I don't know if I'm anywhere near it yet. After CARC.
Well, it took about 5 years at CARC, and then I decided I'd had enough public exposure. Came home to be with my grandchildren.
Oh. And that's when you officially retired from the grain industry?
Yeah, well, it says in here that the last paragraph says, I was very pleased and occurred because personally was
personally it was an opportunity that we were able to put together to get a prairie-wide presence and be able to compete with the new players that are coming up into Canada, particularly from the United States.
From particularly the United States.
You said you worked in a very public business for 19 years. So that would be from 1975, did you start?
That's when you worked at the Manitoba Pool.
Yes. And just as a side light, it's kind of interesting, but rapeseed oil had a couple of amino acids and high glucosinolates, and that gave a flavor that the animals didn't want to eat it. And so Dr. Bell of Saskatchewan and Dr. Wozni of, another medical doctor, he was a doctor, but not like he was a PhD, but it was to do with agriculture. Anyways, the two of them got together and they bred out the glucosinolates and uric acid, which were no good. And so finally, and Canadians still didn't think this was good enough for them. And then Procter & Gamble in the United States hired Mother Walton. Do you remember Mother Waltons?
No.
Well, there was a sort of a soap opera show, but she was very popular. And she said, I would only feed my children Canadian canola oil. And and of course, that had to go through a great long general regard to safe called GRAS. And it took about 2 years to get that through. And they managed to keep it out of politics, because once again, politics, it was expressed on science. And we had one of our highly placed doctors of science, and they had one, and they worked through it, and they said, no, this is okay. And so, of course, in that time, it was a Mal Perkins kind of a show. Mother Walton said, I would only feed my children Canadian canola oil. And so once it was accepted by the Americans, then the Canadians said, well, it might be okay for us too.
And that's become a very, very strong product.
Oh, absolutely. Like we had one of these people, someone, a couple of, well, they'd be 25, 26-year-old women, nutritionists from China. And they, when China accepted it and the U.S. accepted it, Canadians finally decided, well, yeah, maybe it's okay for us to
use it. Yes.
And the resulting, like, canola now in revenue exceeds wheat in dollars brought in, and also, of course, you've got to look at revenue as one thing, profits are another, because you've got to take off all your expenses. And in every way you look at it, canola is now making more money per acre for farmers than wheat. And Canada was acknowledged at the time to have the best wheat in the world. It was called Hard Red Spring, and the better the wheat, the better the flour, the better the bread.
I'm going to go to another question, because I know that we're actually weaving our way through all these questions
That's
as
right.
we speak. I think an interesting section to talk to you about would be the connection with other segments of the grain industry, because it sounds like you were a policy person,
mm-hmm.
you were in Ottawa, you also had your farming background. So I guess I'm asking you generally, because you've now described 3, 4, 5 aspects
mm-hmm.
of your career. What would be the connections you saw between the work you did and the producers, which were the farmers? Or I guess that's one of the producers.
Yeah, well, there again, because I knew about farming, other farmers accepted the recommendations that I might make and would work its way up through to head office.
Mm-hmm.
And your head offices sometimes are pretty slow. Bureaucracy is not willing to change, because one of the unfortunate things is that, and it still is in effect, the more people that report to you, the more money you make. So they'll go out of their way to create meaningless jobs, because then they make more money. And any person in business doesn't view it that way. And seniority is the greatest thing in government. And seniority doesn't play a role. It's ability. Someone may have 5 years experience and they still don't know anything. And someone may have 20 years experience and have a good grasp on things.
Another category is the, and I guess I'm asking you to give broad answers, because we're going over the whole span
mm-hmm.
of your career
mm-hmm.
here. And I guess I'm asking you for your opinions, your conclusions about how all these different parts of the grain industry interacted. Because the next one is the carriers.
The carriers?
Carriers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they mean by that probably
the railways.
The railways and the
trucks.
Shipping. Trucks and
but
shipping.
More because we're such long ways from salt water, it's mostly railways. And as I said, Transport Canada didn't care about the people using the railways. They wanted to make sure that Transport Canada made lots of money.
Did government play any role in that?
Well, of course. Government has a role in everything.
What was your experience over the years and how they handled that?
Well, that's why I was registered as a lobbyist.
And what did you think they should be doing differently?
Well, I would suggest to them ways they could go that would be more productive for the grains industry in Canada and the U.S., because we ship a lot of wheat, and still do, into the U.S. And one of the things is, the further north you go, where you can still grow a good crop, the better the grain is, as long as you don't get caught by frost. Well, the original Red Fife that the Selkirk settlement started with, it took about 110 days to mature, whereas now it can mature in 90 days and still be a good product.
So over the span of your career, I guess there were railroad. It went east, west, and you're saying a lot went south, and then the crow's nest. A lot of interest in this project comes from Thunder Bay.
Yes.
And
We had a terminal in Thunder Bay, and we visited once a year because they felt isolated from Winnipeg, where the grain trade was, and they were so happy to come and see somebody who could get the problems in Thunder Bay get back to the Winnipeg head office.
So over your time, you would, of course, seen the shift between so much grain going through Thunder Bay and it shifting out to the west.
Yeah, well, that's a matter of economics. And by and large, Europe doesn't need our grain much more. In fact, they put all sort of tariff barriers around it. So more goes to Vancouver for Japan and China. Mm-hmm. And Russia at one time was buying 3 million tons of wheat a year. And they would have taken more because they had a crop failure, because they've had a crop failure ever since 1917 when communists took over. And that was when we would ship the grain out through Churchill, because it's very short to get to northern Russia. And then they would take it from there.
And now Russia is not as big a customer.
No, Russia, since they got over their absolute dedication to communism, has made great progress in research. And it's a huge country, and so they've bred different varieties that work well in others. Soybeans are a good crop, and we could never grow soybeans because soybeans are a southern crop. But with breeding we've got now, and people are really doing well with soybeans also. And soybeans, of course, are, as a legume, will leave nitrogen and leave it in the ground, so it helps reduce the cost of fertilizer. And the price is very, very good.
So that's a strong crop now in Canada.
Yes, and it's growing every year as people get to, I guess, say, believe it, mm-hmm. and that it will work and they can grow them. And like we had a national convention last year called the Nuffield Foundation, and it's right from, well, Newfoundland's not in it, but Prince Edward Island to Victoria. And we talk about all the different things that we talk to each other, and we just had the conference last week.
So you're still involved in the grain industry at some point?
Oh, yes, yes.
And you always will be? It sounds like it's a passion of yours.
Well, yes.
Again, I'm going back to the connection with segments within the grain industry, the handlers. Now, that would be, you worked for Manitoba Pool, and you talked about the other pools that you then got together to have discussions. Can you talk about the relationship between perhaps the pools and the private grain companies?
Well, although we're all competitors, all have receptions, and we're friends, and we talk to each other, and not try to give away too much information, and we try not to give away information. But on the whole, it was very useful, and everybody appreciated the opportunity to get together and talk to each other. There was National Grain, and Parrish and Heinbecker, and Pioneer, and UGG, and they're all, of course, Manitoba Pool. They're all happy to get together and have a good time.
Did you see any changes in how business was done over the years?
I mean, from then till now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now there's only three elevator companies, Viterra, Pioneer, and Parrish and Heinbecker. And it's not their fault, but they're spread out so wide that it was difficult for them to get together, except when we had our green parties.
Now, what would be, we've talked about the pools and the private grain grain companies. What would their relationship be to the Canadian Grain Commission?
Well, the Canadian Grains Commission is, in effect, the police of the industry, making sure quality is kept. And they also have what they call assistant commissioners go out and check the elevators to see that they're not stealing grain, that they're grading it properly. And that was very useful to keep the, and they were in effect the quality control people that kept the quality up and that people, foreign buyers, could know that what they ordered, they got. If they wanted low-priced wheat, they fine. They were segregated and they got that. If they wanted high-priced wheat, they were segregated and they knew it was good. And when the Grains Commission put their stamp on it, that it was good, and they wouldn't accept any argument because they said we're right, and that's it. And people soon found that, yeah, it was right. They didn't have to worry about quality concerns because what they said they wanted, winter wheat is a lower quality, but it's better for feed because you get more of it. You wouldn't make bread out of it.
That the Canadian Grains Commission, do you believe still has a role in?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Which then brings us to the topic of the day in Canada.
Mr. Ritz?
Well, the role of the Canadian Wheat Board. What's your opinion on that?
Well, the Canadian Wheat Board did a lot of good because they could maintain quality, and barley, which of course is used in making beer, and it had to be a certain quality, so the commission made sure that those things were always right, and that people didn't have to, what they ordered is what they got. If they wanted less cost grain, they got that, and the higher quality grain, they were willing to pay for it, because they knew when the Grains Commission put their stamp of quality on, that they got what they wanted.
And with the wheat board being the single desk that that all went through, what's your opinion on the role of that?
Well, it was good at its time, but now there's no use trying to maintain a wheat board because everything's, like they could organize it. And the barley had to meet certain standards, and there was always almost a lottery as to who got to get that barley because it paid so well.
What structure do you see them putting in place to take our grain to the international grain trade? What will be the method that you think would work?
I just think it'll work because the commission now regulates, and if any traders are being fraudulent, they were about four went to jail when we got the proposed and then it was enacted, and there were four traders went to jail for fraud.
Could you talk about that more, that when this was and how that happened? And who brought it to the attention of the... I don't know anything about this particular thing, so I need background.
I don't know what more I can say.
Well, there were grain traders for private companies.
Yes.
But who would have noted was it the Canadian Wheat Board or the Grains Commission that noted that this was happening? Because you're talking about the checks and balances in the system, so somewhere in the system it caught these people doing this.
Well, no, it's regulated by competition between the companies and the grain buyers and the grain traders. But still, the Grains Commission puts its stamp.
Mm-hmm.
You want lower-priced wheat for feeding animals, you want high-priced wheat for making good bread, and they still will keep that started out. Now, it'd be more a matter of competition between players.
Okay, and the other connection in the grain industry were the purchasers, and you've mentioned Russia was a customer, and now Japan and the Asian countries are bigger customers. Over your long career, you saw the market shift.
Yes. Europe sets up a whole bunch of conditions. They don't want generally modified products. And there's no reason for it except they just don't want us selling any grain into Europe. And Japan and China, they want grain, and they don't worry about such things. And the commission checks the grains for too many insecticides and then gives their stamp of approval. And so they're happy to deal with Canada and China.
So those are our biggest customers right now, you think?
Yes. China is the biggest customer at the moment.
Okay. You just touched on that Manitoba Pool did have an elevator in Thunder Bay. Do you have any other thoughts on the operations in Thunder Bay?
Well, we went every year at the board, and they always liked to see us because they felt isolated from head office. And
is there still a Manitoba Pool elevator in Thunder Bay?
There's an elevator, but I don't know what it's called. Like, Bungie is big in Canada now, and the names have all changed. Sparrow and Heinbecker.
They've all folded into very few, right? Did the Manitoba Pool have a research component to the business?
It did, yes.
Was it a large part of the business or a small part?
Well, it didn't really cost much money to do the research, but what research did come out was very valuable. And,
so it played its role. You mentioned the grain scientists. Certainly, they weren't at Manitoba Pool, but that were able to impact on the change in the canola. If you look back over your career, what were the major challenges that you felt you faced?
I guess it was the major challenges were to keep the various parts of the organizations from the challenges were being met by people who knew things. Like, as a head of a company, you don't have to know very much. But you have to hire good people. Mm-hmm. And they don't, in the bureaucracies in Ottawa, the more people they report to you, the more money they make. So it creates a whole bunch of useless information for people to work on. And they go to meetings and go back and forth and round and round. And that's not how business works. If someone's got 1 year's experience in doing the job, fine. Someone's had 20 years of experience, doesn't know what they're doing, then they're gone.
Looking back on various, you may have more than one answer to this, but looking back in on the various jobs that you did in the grain industry, what are you most proud of?
I think in getting Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta to be created as one company. And so then when I went to Ottawa, I could be seen as speaking on that segment of the industry, which at that time was about 75% of the grain produced.
And what part of the history of this whole industry do you think is important to preserve and to share with the public that you would like people to know?
Well, the important thing is that the Grains Commission is there and keeps quality control up. And since they've got such a good record and people, when the Grain Commission says this grade is this grade, you want lower grades for animal feed, it's all sorted out. And that's the role of the commission, and of course it will stay there.
Now, are there any questions or any part of your career that we haven't touched upon?
I don't think so.
Maybe we could have a look there and just see. And any questions that I should have asked that I didn't think of? And while we're looking over the article on you, do you have any photographs or memorabilia that
you certainly could, likely want to photograph that. That's fine.
Yeah, that kind of...
And there's no copyright, so you don't have to worry.
Thank you. And always the last question, because as you said, everybody in the grain industry that were there for a long time knew each other. Is there anyone else that you think we should interview?
I know he's talking to Mr. Ritz. He's got a one-track mind.
And Mr. Ritz was the...
But he was the one that was most determined to eliminate the wheat board monopoly.
Oh, all right, okay, yeah. Anyone else you worked with that you think would?
Alan Dawson, who's a reporter, still is reporters for them, spoke to him. He's a very good reporter,
okay.
And he's very thorough. And in watching everything he said, looking at it from the side, to me, he was always right on with the challenges.
And who does he write for? The Manitoba Cooperator?
Manitoba Cooperator. Okay. I think now he works out of his own home, which is down around Morris or something.
Okay.
But he's that.
Okay, good.
The article here talks about your involvement in the Manitoba Rapeseed Association as a founding father.
Yes, I was the founding president of that.
Yes, from 1970 to 1974. Do you have anything more that you wanted? You talked about canola being important.
This is irrelevant, but when you wanted to change the name from rape to canola. And say, you're going to sell women something that starts with rape? I don't think so. So that's why when it's canola, well, that's fine. And actually, the rapeseed word comes from a German. The roots of that language go back to the German language. And that all it meant was there were turnips and that. And they all came under the name of rape seed oil.
Okay. And just for the record, the co-interviewer is Mary Mitchell, so when you heard another voice come in at that point, we at this point are looking at an article written about Mr. Ken Eady in the Manitoba Cooperative on the occasion of his retirement, and this is dated January the 5th, 2000, and we're hoping to be able to get a copy of this for our archives.
Also, you said big railways, big trouble for farmers. I mentioned the trouble we had with railways, and so that outlines the problems with big railways.
It also mentions here another research organization, the Canadian Agriculture Food Research Council.
Yes.
Canadian Agri-Food.
Yeah, I was on the board of that for a while too. Mm-hmm.
What is its role?
Well, they were looking to prevent duplication. Like somebody in Saskatchewan is doing something in Manitoba. And they're both doing the same thing, both come to the same conclusion. So why not just have an organization which says, yes, these conclusions are brought forward by a great number of people, and the Green Commission says quality control, and there's no more problems.
Now, you also talks here in 1972, you were appointed as the first public governor of the Winnipeg Grain Exchange.
Right, you haven't talked about that. Tell us about that.
Which is now the Winnipeg Commodity Exchange.
Yes, actually it's ICE Futures now, but it's the same
organ,
that same thing. I used to write a lot of letters, and I wrote letters to the chairman of the Winnipeg Grain Exchange. Of course, he said, okay, come and help us. And so, by and large, the traders didn't want regulation, and the Futures Act had been proclaimed but wasn't initiated. And one gentleman there, who was a very honest gentleman, and he loved the interplay of things, but if it hadn't been for him, we couldn't have got the documents ratified.
Who was that?
Bill Purvis.
Okay.
He and his brother ran something called Inter-Ocean Grain. They had about 20 elevators in Manitoba. But he was one of these people, was right as right, and he knew that there was problems, but he couldn't get the other ones to agree to happen. And when it got, there was columns in the paper on the people thought I'd gone crazy. Why would you join those bunch of crooks? See if we can improve it, which happened.
That's good.
So then it says here, under federal legislation passed in 1938, the Canadian Grain Commission was to supervise trading,
mm-hmm.
but that act was not proclaimed until the mid-70s.
That's right.
And that's when you said some folks were prosecuted if they were fraudulent.
Yes.
Trading.
Okay.
Because outside scrutiny helps ensure traders play by the rules, giving farmers and the public more confidence. And it wasn't until the 1980s when the Grain Commission uncovered a litany of fraudulent activity by unscrupulous traders that had cost the farmers millions of dollars. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we've covered everything, and we very much appreciated this interview, mm-hmm. So we'd like to thank you.
I enjoy it. And, I was kind of hesitant about getting into this because I was away from home so much. I said, what's that guy doing? Why isn't he staying home and looking after this farm? But I did find out. Was being involved in industry, it paid much better than farming.
It sounds like you had a very valuable point of view to bring to the industry, too.
Thank you.
So I thank you. That's good.